The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to The Kunstler Cast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl, featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. I'm Duncan Crary, and for today's show, we'll be discussing the relationship between peak oil and suburbia. Hey, Jim, I'm back again for another round. Are you ready?
Not you.
I think it's time. We have a lot of new listeners. We also have a lot of listeners who know you through The Long Emergency, and we have another camp who knows you pretty much through The Geography of Nowhere, meaning that some people know you as a suburban sprawl critic, and some people know you as like a peak oil prophet or a peak oil proponent. And occasionally I see sort of conflicting views, like, why is Jim talking about this topic when, you know, he's supposed to be talking about this other topic? So could you, for today, walk us through not only the connection between suburban sprawl and peak oil, but, you know, your own discovery of the significance of peak oil, you know, after writing or while writing The Geography of Nowhere?
I guess we'd have to really go back to the 1970s. And I had just gotten a job on a daily newspaper. I came out of the hippie newspapers of Boston in 1972. And I got a full-time job on the evening paper in Albany, New York, and it was a Hearst newspaper. I got there in August of 1973, and about 3 months later or so, we got into the OPEC oil embargo, and that was stimulated by the Yom Kippur War between Israel, Egypt, and Syria. And that war provoked what was called the OPEC embargo. It wasn't quite an embargo, but it was a threat that upset the market so much that it took a lot of oil off the market, and there were shortages and lines at the gasoline stations and et cetera. Now, the newspaper had just established itself in a brand new building on this heroic boulevard of strip shopping about 10 miles outside of Albany, New York. It had moved from a building downtown out to the suburbs. And so we were covering the story of the OPEC oil embargo, and it was a huge local story, of course, a local story everywhere, but it was pretty severe in our region. A lot of the gas stations were not getting gas, and there were lines everywhere, and tempers were flaring, and people were beating each other up, and guns were brandished, and it was quite a story. And also, there were very few people driving for a while. The whole thing only lasted a couple of months. And I think the worst of it only ran about 3 or 4 weeks. But for that time, people really drove almost not at all if they possibly could avoid it. And the highways were empty. The streets were empty. It was like the day the earth stood still. It was very peculiar. And it made a huge impression on me because, you know, here I was a young reporter, about 25 years old or so, and I saw the world stop as we had known it, and especially seeing this happen in the new burgeoning suburbia as it was being built out and elaborated. So it made a huge impression on me, and then it was over. You know, it came to an end. It did provoke a lot of changes and troubles for the rest of the decade. We had an economy that was badly upset by oil prices that rose very quickly, very steeply. And we had stagflation, which was a new phenomenon that nobody had ever seen before. When you have inflation plus a stagnating economy, that was a novelty. And you began to see the American manufacturing sector fall apart. The first manifestation, of course, was the Japanese car makers started to get the upper hand over Ford and General Motors. And, you know, they had been all geared up to the American car makers were all tooled up to build these giant cars the size of ferry boats. And in comes Nissan and Honda and Datsun, as it was called at the time. And they're selling, you know, cars that are 3 feet shorter and use a third of the amount of gas. And all of a sudden, Americans are buying them like crazy. And you saw all kinds of other changes going on. And, you know, I'd moved on in the meantime. And, you know, I went to Rolling Stone for a while, came back, embarked on my career as a bohemian novel writer, you know, wrote a whole bunch of novels, you know, didn't get rich and famous, but kept on going, doing it. And then I returned to nonfiction and journalism after my sojourn in the wilderness of fiction. And I started writing, the New York Times Magazine sent me out on a bunch of stories about suburban development in New England, because a lot of them owned summer houses in Vermont and Massachusetts, and they were getting hip to the idea that the countryside was getting, as they would put it, overdeveloped. You know, all of a sudden, malls were popping up in places like the Berkshires and in Vermont, you know, when formerly they had only been in New Jersey and Long Island. But now, oh my God, they're putting a mall up where I have my summer house. It's not like the country anymore. So they sent me out there to cover that story from a bunch of angles, and I did. And that stimulated me to, I left something out. We had the 1979 Iran oil problem, which was stimulated by the revolution in Iran when they threw the Shah out. And that was more of a price jacking than a supply problem, because there was still, we didn't have gas lines so much in that for that episode, but the price went way up by today's standards. It went from like 60 cents a gallon for gasoline to like $1.60. So that was a huge shock to America too, and it was largely responsible for the recession of 1980-81 that Reagan had his early years of his term in. Anyway, I'm ahead of myself and behind myself. So there I am, 8 years later, writing stories for the New York Times Magazine about suburban development. And that turned into a book proposal. The book I originally had in mind came out of a New York Times article that I was writing called Why is America So Fucking Ugly? That was sort of the working title between me and the editors. You know, it wouldn't have been the title they published, but that's how we understood the theme of the thing was going to be. And I did it that way because that was the most obvious manifestation of what we were doing and how we were building America, was that it was ugly. But the more first of all, the story was killed, not because of the title, but because they had instituted a new rule at the Times that the stories could not exceed 4,000 words. And this one went way over that, and there was no way of even touching on the subject, you know, in less. So I took that story that was killed and turned it into a proposal, which was sold pretty rapidly. There was a little bit of an auction between Simon & Schuster imprint called Summit Books and Knopf. And Summit eventually outbid them. You know, it wasn't a huge contract, but it was more money than I'd made before. And the working title of the book was going to be Scary Places, because America was getting scary, you know, I mean, and in me, it was inducing, you know, kind of placophobia, you know, because all of a sudden, you know, there are all these places you don't want to be in anymore, you know, because they're just so horrifying. Anyway, so Scary Places was written. It took me about 3 years, and they decided they didn't like the title because it sounded too much like a horror novel. So I
for 3-year-olds.
Yeah, for 3-year-olds. Like, you know, Where the Wild Things Are or something. So I just switched out the title of the first chapter, which was called The Geography of Nowhere. So the first chapter became Scary Places, and the chapter of the book became The Geography of Nowhere. And in that book, you know, I was touching upon the idea that sooner or later we were going to run into problems with oil. And, you know, I based it on the fact that, first of all, I'd had this experience as a young man of the OPEC oil embargo, knowing that our oil imports were going up and up and up and up, and that they were going to continue to go up, that the proportion of oil we imported would only go up and become ever larger, and that it would become ever more of a threat and a problem for us. So, you know, I touched on it a little. You know, I'll read one little sentence maybe out of the book, but...
Yeah.
You know, on the spur of the moment, I didn't have time to reread the whole book and find the places where I referred to oil. But I said something like, I was describing the what was going on in the early 90s as the mindless twitchings of a brain-dead culture, artificially sustained by the intravenous feeding of cheap oil. Indeed, the continuation of a cheap oil supply through the 1980s, a temporary quirk of politics and history, has been a disaster, allowing us to postpone the necessary redesign of America. So you could sort of see the way things were shaping up out there. Now, what I didn't realize was that because of the North Sea discoveries and the Alaska Prudhoe Bay discoveries, that that would extend that cheap oil interlude through the 90s. And in fact, oil got just cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. What happened was the North Sea and Alaska took the leverage away from OPEC and other oil-producing nations who didn't like us.
Okay, so Jim, you definitely alluded to peak oil in the geography of nowhere. It was in your mind, but you didn't dedicate an entire chapter to the topic.
I wouldn't say that I thought of it in that term, peak oil. The way I thought of it, really, for my purposes at that time, was we have an oil import problem that's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. You know, indeed it has. But peak oil came about a different way. I went on to write a sequel to The Geography of Nowhere called Home from Nowhere. And that was published in 1996. And it was largely a result of me meeting the new urbanists, the guys who were the real reformers out there in the urban design, architecture, town planning fields. And they were so interesting and stimulating and intelligent. And I just got such a bang out of seeing what they proposed as the remedy for this crazy way of life we developed. And it included people like Andres Duany and his wife, Elizabeth Platter-Zyberg, who went on to become the dean of the University of Miami Architecture School and Urban Design School, and Peter Calthorpe out in Berkeley, and Doug Kelbaugh, who was at the University of Washington at the time, and a lot of very cool people. The list is very long.
So you found them after you wrote The Geography of Nowhere?
At the end of The Geography of Nowhere, I encountered these people, and I started hanging out with them a lot after that. Home from Nowhere was largely concerned with the remedies to suburbia in terms of urban design and architecture. Really, how we were going to rebuild the human habitat in America in a way that would have a future, that would be sustainable, that would be more rewarding to be in, you know, wouldn't be punishment. And it was hugely stimulating to find these guys. But around the same time that was published in the mid-1990s, a group of senior geologists started retiring out of the oil industry. And as soon as they established their pensions safely and retired into comfort, they started to publish their secret dark thoughts about where the oil industry was headed. These were characters like Colin Campbell and Kenneth DeFays. And DeFays had been, I guess, a Texaco geologist who then went on to Princeton and became an academic. Colin J. Campbell had worked for the European companies, Total, and some others. And there were some other figures who were also publishing. And what they were saying was, here we are in the mid-1990s. We know from the models that our teachers in geology devised before us in the 1950s and 60s, that there's a certain profile to the oil story, you know, that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we're going to call this the peak oil story. The model was mostly devised by this one particular guy, Marion King Hubbert, who was a industry geologist and an academic. He was at Columbia. He was at the Colorado School of Mines. He worked for a number of the major American oil companies. And he devised what was called, what came to be called the Hubbert curve, which is a bell curve, which basically says, you know, you, the oil industry starts and you're producing very little of it, and then you're ramping it up and the curve goes up and you're producing a whole lot. And then you reach a certain point of maximum all-time production. And from there, you enter the arc on the other side of the bell curve, and that's the arc of depletion. And that is how the oil story will play out. And it will probably begin to peak in the late 1990s or early 2000s. And Hubbert lived until about 1988. So he, you know, his career spanned a very long time, from the infancy of the oil industry to the to near peak. And he called it pretty well. One of the things he was famous for calling, and one of the things that we learned from these guys who were publishing in the 1990s, was that America had already gone through its peak in 1970. That was the most, that was the year we produced the most oil that we will ever produce. And it was something like 10 million barrels a day. Now we're down to under five, okay? And it was one of the reasons that the OPEC oil embargo happened, because you only knew through the rearview mirror view that our production had peaked in 1970 by looking at the production figures from 71, 72, and 73. And it began to be obvious and evident that we could not produce more than we had in 1970. And it not only became obvious to us and to our people and our engineers and our military people and et cetera, it also became kind of known internationally, and the OPEC nations figured it out. And when they figured that out, they seized the pricing control. And that was what brought on, apart from the Yom Kippur War and the, you know, the wish to manipulate the West over Israel, you know, what really happened was that OPEC seized pricing control, because they could continue to increase their production, which meant that they could make the price go up or go down. They could make the price go down if they produced more, or they could neck down the production and drive the price up. We could only produce as much as we could, because we needed it so badly. We were importing oil back then, and we had to produce as much as we could. And we couldn't neck down. We had to just keep on getting it from the guys overseas. So all of a sudden, we're deathly dependent on them. We can increase our production to make up for the increasing number of cars we're driving. And you know, I don't remember this offhand, but I believe that the figure from the 1970s was something like we were using like 13 million barrels of oil a day. And now, you know, we're up to 20, 22 million barrels a day in our time. So our oil consumption increased tremendously through the late 80s and 1990s. Anyway, so these guys retired out of the system. We learned about the American oil peak, but Mr. Hubbert had also gone on to model the global oil peak and the beginning of global depletion. And I think he predicted it would be, you know, 1998 would be the beginning of this. And he was off by a few years. It turned out that the peak was 2005, at least through the rearview mirror 4 years back now. It appears that we produced the most conventional crude oil ever in 2005 and haven't really exceeded it.
Jim, is that a contested factor?
Oh, I think that there are some, you know, a lot of people want to include the natural gas condensates and the non-conventional oil. But as far as, you know, liquid crude coming out of the ground, that was the peak. And, you know, what we're seeing now are also things that are debatable, like the amount of natural gas condensate that we're getting in liquid form, you know, tends to be coming out in large amounts because the old supergiant oil fields are capping off. And it's a phenomenon of what happens at the, you know, as an oil field is dying, that a lot of natural gas liquids are being produced. So to some extent, it's only a symptom of the fact that the old great oil fields are dying. But it's not hugely contested. I think that there's a general understanding from looking at the figures that at least since 2005, we've entered what we call the bumpy plateau period, which is looking at the peak close up. Like if you looked at the tip of a hypodermic needle under a strong microscope, you'd see it's not exactly smooth. You know, it has little imperfections in it. Well, the top of the tippy top of the peak oil also is not just a totally smooth thing. It's composed of little bumps, and that's where we've been at for the last, you know, four years or so. But we are, you know, we're getting a lot of signals that we're now entering the robust period of depletion. Anyway, you asked me, you know, how I got onto this. So that was about 1996. And it still was a rather esoteric issue. It wasn't something, it certainly wasn't being discussed in the mainstream media or even in the more esoteric journals, really. The intellectual places like the Atlantic Monthly and Harper's, you know, they weren't really talking about it there either. But the internet was starting to ramp up around that time. And it was a subject that was coming up on the internet, along, by the way, with Y2K. These are two interesting phenomena that were, both of them were really not paid much attention to in the media. You know, one of them turned out to be a problem that was solved because it was a very specific, limited problem. It was a large problem, but it was limited and specific. The peak oil problem, the more you looked at it, it presented really horrendous implications for us. You know, the biggest one being, how is an industrial society going to run itself when we run into supply problems with oil? And also, of course, hand in hand with that went the idea that oil is not distributed equitably around the world. You know, it tends to be in certain places and not in other places. And unfortunately, some of the places that have the most of it are the places that we don't get along with very well, namely the Islamic world or Russia. So there was that problem, which, you know, stimulated the geopolitical side issues of peak oil. And a lot of these issues were self-explanatory. You didn't have to be a PhD to understand that if, you know, 75% of the oil in the world was controlled by people who didn't like the United States, you know, and if you combine that with the idea that production is peaking in the whole world, then this doesn't bode very well for how we're going to get on, especially in relation to a society that's completely been sucked into car dependency of the most extreme kind, you know, that that has created an entire living arrangement based on car dependency, which represents the investment of all of its post-World War II wealth, you know, in the strip malls and the housing tracts and all of the equipment of daily life, you know. So you could see in the swirl of all these issues, a very disturbing picture begin to present itself of, you know, here we are with suburbia, and I have just finished writing three books about suburbia. By the way, I published another book called The City in Mind in 2002 while I was being exposed to the whole peak oil thing. And in The City in Mind, I had chapters about Atlanta and Las Vegas. And, you know, I wrote quite a bit about the prospect of places like Atlanta and Las Vegas becoming not working, not being able to function. You know, it became self-evident that these were tremendous problems. You know, after that book came out, I was dwelling more and more on the petroleum story, and it seemed to me that it deserved a book. And now, you know, in the Long Emergency book, which was the result of that, the oil story is in the foreground of that and its implications for daily life in America. And then, you know, in the train behind that thought comes the issue of, well, our way of life depends on this, including suburbia, which I've written about in detail and described its shortcomings. And now we're going to have to contend with the fact that it will fail. So that's pretty much the sequence of how those things happened, you know, and it formed and informed a point of view in me that has been a long continuing thing now for about 20 odd years or more, actually, because, you know, in fact, if you go back to the 1970s and 80s, when I wrote some of my early novels, some of them have themes involving suburban development and the sort of the tragedy of it. And that came from, you know, my experience in the 70s with the OPEC oil embargo and seeing our society come to a halt for a brief period of time. So it's been a long haul for me with this issue. And, you know, and projecting into the future, I did write a post-oil novel called World Made by Hand that was published in the spring of 2008. Just coming out in paperback now in January or February of 2009, but I'm writing a sequel to that now. So I'm trying to take another look and get a closer look at this world that I've created of the post-oil American future. But I also have a contract to write another nonfiction book about the diminishing returns of technology. And, you know, it's something that we've talked about before on this show, and something that I think is one of the great underappreciated elements of the story of our time. You know, how we're screwing ourselves with our grandiose overinvestments in complexity and ignoring the blowback from them. So anyway, does that bring us up to date?
I believe that is a very comprehensive explanation of how we got from there to here, Jim. Thanks for sharing that with
us. Well, I hope it wasn't too blabbery, you know, I apologize because it's kind of a long, complex story, and I'm kind of, I've been around the block quite a few times now, and it is interesting to me. I mean, I'm not a narcissist or anything, but it is weird to me, you know, how the journey that I took from, starting to write about the suburbs to starting to write about what has turned out to be a kind of a comprehensive collapse of life as we've enjoyed it. And once again, I would emphasize, you know, I'm not a doomer. I don't think this is the end of the world. I don't think life is over. I don't think American culture is over. But I do think we're going to be living it very differently in the years ahead.
Well, Jim, I have tons of questions to ask you about what we talked about today, but I'm going to save them for the weeks to come because we've got plenty more weeks ahead of us.
That's good.
So thanks a lot for talking with me, Jim.
It's nice to be with you as usual, and I look forward to seeing you again.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener a comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, read transcripts, learn about our theme music, join our mailing list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at KunstlerCast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Robert Ruffo. And, you know, I think you might be surprised by how many people listen to your show, maybe people in power, you know, people who can make a lot of changes fairly easily that would benefit our living environment. And in that hope that some of those people are actually listening, I have the following suggestion for Barack Obama and his team. A huge number of people, according to several surveys done by Gallup and others, apparently more than half the American population would prefer to live in a walkable, fairly high-density environment, you know, a walkable small town or a walkable city center. But unfortunately, where they live, such housing is simply not available because it's illegal due to ridiculous zoning laws that were written in the 1940s for whatever equally ridiculous reasons. These laws have been terribly destructive in the built environment. Some people do live in suburbia by choice, but apparently less than half of them. So all Obama could do to really make, all he would have to do to make a gigantic difference in the American landscape, reduce dependence on foreign oil, reduce carbon emissions, and, you know, get the country rolling in a very right direction, would be to simply, you know, put out a presidential order to repeal these laws, to make it illegal to have single-use, low-density zoning. Or, you know, maybe some people in existing suburbs would be upset by that. At least set aside land in every metropolitan area for high-density zoning. Make that a presidential decree, because there really is much more demand for high-density housing than there is supply. And all the supply is waiting for is the legal right to create it. I mean, the American environment does have to be rebuilt, but first it has to be given the legal right to do so. So that's it. Keep on putting out that podcast. I think it, whether people agree with it or not, it makes everybody think.